herd immunity, that is, gives widespread immunity and decreases the amount of transmission in the community from person to person. So what has been our goal? Our goal has been, and you've heard the term flatten the curve, until we get a vaccine or effective antiviral medications for the coronavirus, and we really don't have anything that's very effective for it yet, the goal has been to flatten the curve. And all flattening the curve does is it pushes the cases into the future. So it prevents people from getting the infection now when we don't have any treatment for it. And it pushes it into the future until we have a vaccine. And we were just doing great until May 26th. And that was, and I'm looking at a graph on my wall, you can't see it, but we peaked up and then we rounded the corner and then we're down very low case counts. And now we're higher than we've been at any point in this saga. We peaked out just like we predicted on April 20th, and now we're blown by that with a straight up line, and it's really unfortunate. While controversial, and I recognize it as such, stay-at-home orders worked. I'm not suggesting that again. Canceling schools absolutely worked. The states that did it early had the lowest amount of impact of the illness in terms of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. What happened on May 26th is a legislative activity led to a compromise that resulted in the mass gathering mandates and those things being punted to the counties. 90% of the counties bailed, and Katie barred the door. That's exactly what we shouldn't have done, and we're right back at it again. Last week in Lawrence, there was 86 confirmed cases so far. There'll probably be 10 times that from three bars, three sports bars. With 86 confirmed cases, I'm sure we'll get to be 10 times that by the time we do all the contact tracing. So it's just 67 cases at Aggieville last week. And that doesn't include Lake Perry gatherings and the like. So we took a big bite out of that. We postponed a lot of cases, saved a lot of hospitalizations and deaths. I'm sure thousands, actually, by those draconian measures. And by the way, and I want to make this very clear to you guys, I do not favor business closures, okay? But we have to get serious about other mitigating possibilities. And I hope that I could show you a ton of literature. I won't, because it's masks work. Simple, plain. We've proven that since the 1500s with bubonic plague in 1527. In H1N1 in 2009, 2003 and 4, with SARS, which is the coronavirus, by the way. The question has been asked and answered, do masks work? Yes, they work. Next time you go under surgery, do you want the surgeon to be standing over you for 3 hours with not having a mask on? And if the answer is, I just assume he wear a mask, then we should just say to whoever is a naysayer, then I won't say what I almost said, but it would be, heck, then you wear a mask too. Now, you don't have to worry when you're outside walking around a park and all that kind of thing, because you've got plenty of room, you've got good air movement. If you're in your office like I am here, a big office with great air handling and everything, nobody else in here with me, I'm not worried about that. I wash my hands, I wear a mask when I go into an area where I can't control my environment. So big decisions coming up on school. And the like, but I just want you to know that, I typically don't speak for Governor Kelly, and I'm not going to right now, except to say that our motivation is to keep business thriving, but safe. And believe me, I've learned more about packing plants and nursing homes and prisons and other food processing places, restaurants. And I recognize that you guys are not quite in that business sector, but there's some of those things that kind of lap up to have some of the same concerns. So let me go through the questions, and I'll read you the questions, and I'll answer them as expeditiously as I can. How many autopsies have been run to see how the virus attacks the system? Thousands, thousands of autopsies have been done. We know a lot about the pathology of where the virus is. And then it says, if none, well, that's obviously not the case, but a couple things. One is the COVID-19 tests that we do that's from the nasopharynx or from the mouth or from the blood and any tissues, really. And we've tested brain and heart and kidneys and liver, et cetera. You can identify the COVID-19. The COVID-19 testing is very good, and it is specific for COVID-19, not one of the other common cold viruses. which is can be a coronavirus. So we found it in all sorts of different tissues, which is not surprising because you've seen young people have strokes. We've seen people go in with what's thought to be acute myocardial infarction, i.e. a heart attack, but it's a COVID infection of the vessels of the blood. We see a lot of people that are hospitalized need to be on acute kidney dialysis. And the reason is it goes after the kidneys. Next question. The statistics show that more than 50% of confirmed cases end up as cleared. I presume that means with complete resolution, which is true. Percentage-wise, Kansas per capita, we're talking about 1% of the population has been infected. The question is this an uncommon disease or is it common? And the one of the things we know for sure, that only about 1% of Kansans have been identified with a positive case by way of testing. But I would predict that it's probably more like 2 to 3% have been infected, because as you're hearing more and more about, a lot of them are asymptomatic, and we're finding that out all the time. And most people do get over it, but there's been tens of thousands of people that that have had strokes and heart problems that have been the residual. We've had people that have gotten lung transplant, a 20-year-old healthy person that had to have a bilateral lung transplant. I'm sure she'll die from after having lung transplants, which is not good. So to think that it's either one and done, you either get it and you get hot, get over it uneventfully, which is, by the way, the case with most young people, that would be ideal. But there's a lot of residual, but most people resolve it uneventfully if they don't die. And it's hard to report on resolution of cases because people say, oh, you're hiding something. No, they mostly get over it. But we don't track, you know, if they're not ever hospitalized, we may never even know about them, you know, so it's hard to track them to resolution. Can you tell me if we are in round one, or what some people would refer to as wave one? If so, predict when round two will hit. We are in wave one, clearly. We've taken a bite out of it with all the draconian measures that were taken early on, and they were very successful for it, but we've opened the floodgates, and people are just going crazy, doing things they shouldn't be doing. So we are very much in wave one. And think of the number of cases. I'm doing a dramatic hand motion, like a Nike swoosh. And what we did is we pushed the swoosh out, but now we're on the straight up part of the Nike swoosh. They're probably going to get mad at me for using their brand to describe something less as severe as COVID-19, but I'll take my chances on that. So we are in wave one. We've done some really good work. And I mean, when I say we count, you know, people as individuals, groups, et cetera. But I do think that a lot of the counties were way too lax and don't take it near seriously enough. I was glad to see, I contributed to the discussion, as you might expect, about the state fair closure. And I like the state fair as much as anybody. And yet that was going to be a bad mistake. Do you believe in the mask order will continue for the next 9 to 10 months? People are walking right through that mask order as it is. Yeah, there's an order out there, but doesn't mean anybody's doing it. Now, it goes in pockets. I was down at the city market in Kansas City, Mo, last weekend, and I bet 95% of people had masks on. But then again, it's fairly densely crowded. I hate masks. I've worn masks for 42 years. I've been a doctor for 42 years. The day I arrived in the Middle East, it was 130 degrees. One of the first things I did was put on a surgical mask and went to work. I'll tell you, that's not for the faint-hearted. And so I've made a career of wearing masks. I don't like them, but they've been important. I've never been sick. And I've been exposed to cholera and Ebola and all sorts of stuff, but I'm attentive to it. And we really have something to learn about wearing masks. They do work. What I would suggest is, by the way, experiment around and get some good ones, because we're going to be in this for a while. For example, this one I'm holding up here is a KN95, which is a knockoff of an N95. We were going to buy 3 million of them for our stockpile, but I said, no, let me take a look at them first. They don't even make a good coffee filter. They're such crappy masks. And keep in mind, 3 million masks at $5 a mask or $4 a mask, that ain't chump change. That would have been, what, a $12 million investment for something I couldn't even use to make coffee. So experiment with masks and get comfortable in them. A mask is always a good idea when you cannot control your environment and you're around people. Do you believe a vaccine can be developed before or after the first quarter of 2021? I don't think so. And the reason I say that, I mean, you hear all sorts of experts talk about it, but they're still in phase one of testing, which is not for efficacy, not just test if it works or not, it's to test if it's safe. So they're still months down the road from to get through the safety trials. A few more questions and then I'll be done. When a vaccine is developed, will it be free to anyone? The pharmaceutical companies will have an opportunity to charge whatever they want. And if you're reading in the news now, it says that the pharmaceutical companies are talking about not gaining profit on it. Right. Yeah, I fell off a turnip truck yesterday. I think what I can say is that beyond nice words, the government has made a huge investment into vaccine development. The private companies will own the patent as long as they fully disclose what they're doing. And there might be some freebies coming out early on. But when they say no, not profiting, does that mean they'll cover their costs? And then I'm no accountant, but I do know that there's a lot, you know, expense or cost of something is depends on what you want to show for it. I'm suspicious, but what we would love to see is that there's not profiteering that's unreasonable. We'll be watching for that. The remdesivir, which is an experimental treatment that we're using now on humans, has been provided to us for free, but it's not going to be for free much longer. And then the Gilead Pharmaceuticals is going to charge quite an arm and a leg for it. I hope by that time we'll know if this stuff works at all or not. Okay, number 7. What is the outlook for Kansas for the next 7 months? Do you anticipate an infection spike? And the answer is, yeah, we're already in the thick of it again. I think that what we're seeing is that the hope for a seasonality that it was going to die down in the summertime, I don't think is bearing fruit. I do think that sunshine is a friend to humans and helps us fight off the virus. And it's fascinating, and this is early evidence suggesting that vitamin D, vitamin D, you ingest it, and then you go in the sunshine and it converts it to the active vitamin D, seems to be very important for COVID-19. It doesn't prevent people from getting the infection, but it makes them so they don't get sick and much less likely to die. So we've seen in studies that have looked at critically ill patients, if they have a low vitamin D, they die. If they have a higher vitamin or normal vitamin D level in their blood, they don't tend to die. There's a lot of people out there that are starting to use that early evidence and but follow the proper dosing guidelines to say, that might be the reason that it's because it's sunshine, it might be converting to the active vitamin D form, which may be the secret sauce. More to follow, that's hot off the press. If Kansas localized the outbreak of infections to meatpacking plants, nursing homes, wouldn't the numbers be minuscule for others getting the virus? Yeah, there's the congregate living situations. You pointed out, although meatpacking isn't congregate living, we've had another kind of food processing as well. Reesers, Fine Foods here in Topeka. I'm saying it out loud because it's been all over the press. By the way, and we don't tend to release names of companies because we think it's really important to not besmirch good reputations. But I do like it when businesses cooperate with us so that we don't have to go public and say, if you were at this establishment from this date to that date, then you might want to check in because there was a known outbreak during that time. But the thing you have to remember about places like nursing homes, prisons, and state hospitals is that the virus doesn't just pop up. It comes in from the community. That is community spread. So yeah, if we can push down the numbers in those congregate living situations, the whole picture gets better, but it's still gonna spread from people to people. You know, like I said, it'll be hundreds just in bars in Aggieville, and I'm not picking on them, I'm just using them as an example, but it is kind of a chilling thought with school and, you know, universities and colleges and community colleges coming back in the fall. It's gonna take a lot of resolve to get there. Last question, and then I'll get to the chat box. And this is a critical issue. Would there be benefit if we had a statewide shutdown again? And of course, I answered that already. Yes, there's no question that it would benefit it, but the cost is too great and probably unnecessary. I think if people commit to the things we've been preaching about social, physical distancing, surface cleaning, hand hygiene, and mask wearing, and don't go out and do dumb things. I mean, that sounds, you know, if you don't need, you know, don't go hang around a bunch of, you know, we see a lot of funerals. We've had people get outbreaks at funerals and deaths from funerals. You talk about adding sadness to sadness. I would say just look into your heart and say, and look into your brain and say, does this make any sense? And if the answer is no, I'm going to get infected there, then stay home. Okay, a couple questions. You want me to go ahead and do these questions?
I have one question that was sent to me before you get to the chat box, Secretary. Okay. A lot of our convenience stores are in real small towns, and people will post on their Facebook pages that, you know, they've been confirmed positive with COVID, and then people see them walking in and out of their convenience stores. How do you suggest they handle that if they're not under a mandatory mask, order, or just in general, what tips do you have for them?
Now, are these people that coming in that are known to be positive for COVID-19 at that time?
Yeah. Well, I don't know the answer to that.
Because if they had COVID-19 and they're more than about 10 days out from the onset of symptoms, then it's no harm, no foul. They should still be wearing masks and exhibiting good hand hygiene. We don't know if the antibodies that people develop will prevent them from getting sick again. But people quit shedding the virus, the active virus, after about 10 days from the onset of symptoms. Or the onset of when they had their positive test result. What I would recommend is to, if somebody knows somebody, say, I know that you've just had, just ask them, I know you've been sick with COVID-19 lately, should you really be in here? And please put on a mask and take care of yourself and take care of us. I know that those kind of assertiveness approaches are not good. The other thing you can do is call the county health department and let them know. You could call law enforcement, but that's a bit heavy-handed. I think I'd rather try something a little bit more congenial first. But the county health department can give them a call too. And we said, well, part of contact tracing, we want to make sure that you're doing things right and that how you doing, by the way. I it's a little softer touch.
Okay.
Some people take a ball peen hammer to the forehead to give them a wake-up call, but I don't recommend that as a first measure.
Might be smarter.
And probably more effective. Let's see. Kansas has seen increases in suicide and or drug overdoses in the past few months. You know, interestingly, overall, our total death count per capita is down. But when you dig into it, the suicides have been steady. Intentional drug overdoses have been steady, and the reason the death count is down is because there's been fewer car accidents. So we've had a dramatic uptick. You know, when you think about the number of deaths, it's from nationwide and in our state is far more than what influenza does. And we've gotten there in 3 months. We blew by all of annual influenza. We blew by that, and that which is a 12 month tally. We blew by that, but then, so just people who have been not traveling as much, and there's been fewer deaths, but not a dramatic increase yet in suicides and drug overdoses. But we have had a lot of, I think, mental health issues that are another very serious reasons to get the economy straight, get people back to some semblance of normal. But we're doing it very badly right now, and especially in Sedgwick County. Sedgwick is the one they're going to overrun the hospital within the next week, or hospitals. I got an 11 o'clock call today with hospital leaders from all over the state, and it'll not be a happy conversation. Hmm. Is there a list of COVID testing sites in Kansas? Yes, there's 52-ish, I think, testing locations, and that is on our website. If you haven't been to our KDHE website, go there and click on the COVID-19 micro site. It is a fascinating assortment of things that you will find helpful, including frequently asked questions, a comparison of Kansas to other states, comparison county to county, but that it has all the sites listed on there. Testing info. There we go. Oh, thank you, Bob. That must be you. He's my own Bob Jurgens. Johnny on the spot. Is KDHE working on a phone-based tracking application? We are doing that now. We have what's called, Bob, help type it out there. What's the name of that program that we have? Salesforce is the name of it. So we've been doing tracking all along. I will say, and I'm going to, you know, how political COVID-19 has become is crazy. The Attorney General inserted some language into House Bill 2016 that disallows any kind of GPS type device for tracking and contacts and doing contact tracing. That's fine. We have never used GPS tracking devices anyway. But it also puts, and this affects you guys, it says that to do contact tracing, we have to have, we can contact we know if we have a positive test from somebody, let's say one of your employees, we can call them because that's part of the state statute that requires us to investigate infectious disease outbreaks. But the law, 2016, the Attorney General is meeting with our lawyers right now, says that they have to get approval to contact any of those contacts. Because we, in an average, if somebody becomes infected, the average is that 10 people around them will be contacted. But we have had as many as 403 contacts of one infected individual. You talk about the manpower needs to do that. So if I had any to say anything, we did great with the, our meatpacking plants, for example, never shut down. Reese's Fine Foods never shut down. And the reason was we had good cooperation and so that we could do contact tracing and then go in and help to figure it out. We are very much, and your county health department, same thing, very much in a partnering mode because the worst thing that we would I would never want, and I have not had to do this yet, I was a hair's breadth from it, was having a company that said, you know, blah, flip the middle finger and said, we are not going to cooperate with you on that. And I said, but just yesterday, or 2 days, it was a Sunday, I remember, we tested and 256 out of their 530 people were positive. And they want to keep it open and keep it. And I said, there's two things that happen. If you don't cooperate is one, I'm going to shut you down because I can do that. And second is I'm going to announce it publicly what you're doing. So, because we have to, in the public interest, let people know where there's a huge outbreak so they don't get sick and die in their homes. The oxygen got richer and they cooperated and we did really well together
you got on the same page.
We have not had, it's not been steeped in confrontation because the intent is just to do the right thing by our citizenry. That's all I have. Oh, there's one more, I guess.
It looks like there's two more questions, yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm taking more than my time allotted.
Oh, you're fine.
You're fine.
Okay. I've read there is a different variant that is much more contagious. Is that what you're seeing in Kansas now? You know, there's minor, what we call genetic drift, but there really is the same virus. It isn't genetically distinct. So I don't think so. It's because the reason for the increased spread is not the virus, it's the humans. And the humans are doing things wrong. Good question, though. When you post travel restrictions to other states, as far as stay at home after returning, are these retroactive or current? It starts at the moment that we post it, there's 14 days from that day forward. You have to put a stake in the ground. There's only two states, it'll change today. There's only two states, Florida and Arizona, that are on that list now. There would be more, except that we are catching up to states and we are on other states. I'm trying to think of a better word than list. Yeah, we are on other states' list, and it's because we've just opened up the floodgates, and we should not let that happen. And by the way, it's not magic. The way we do this is we compute our new case development, 14-day rolling average, compare it to every other state. We do the same computation, and if that state is three times or more greater than ours, then that's what makes it the list. If we said the threshold was, if their rate of growth of new cases is two times, then there'd be 32 states on there where there'd be travel restrictions. So it doesn't really provide much help. Other countries are not as much of a concern anymore. They're all lower than we are. We improve our lot if we have people come from foreign countries, maybe with the exception of China. But that's only because we don't get the truth from them. We really never know. Why did the testing take 3 to 7 days to receive results? It's because the Quest and the large commercial labs are getting swamped, and the federal government, for all the promises, has not kept up. We are in Kansas, we're one of 12 states that has exceeded our testing threshold every day, week, month. So our testing numbers are adequate, but this is the heart of a question as a problem, and that is, if you get it, takes 3 to 7 days. By the way, our state lab is 1 day turnaround from the time we receive the sample. But the 3 to 7 days doesn't help you that much. Imagine a kid, you send them home for 7 days waiting for the result. Well, if they're sick, you would anyway, of course. Or an employee, would you send them home waiting for 7 days? Yeah, you'd send them home if they're sick, but when do you bring them back? If in 2 days they're feeling better. So we have to do whatever we can. And Governor Kelly, bless her heart, she's even gone all the way to federal government. She sat in with President Trump in the White House and had a nice little conversation with them. That helped for a while with the open the floodgates and of testing materials, but we're getting so much more. The number of testing with this spike, imagine, again, every time you test one person, you're going to probably test 10 more around them. So every 10 people, you can drop it down 100. I mean, the numbers are spectacular. We're doing 5,000 tests a month, or 5,000 tests a day in Kansas right now with in our internal labs, either commercial. Or we've recruited in like the K-State rabies lab that does 700 tests a day. We do more than 1,000 in our state lab. And then the private companies make up the rest. It's everything I know. That's all I know.
Mr. Secretary, the one question I have is going back to your comment about when an employee has been either not infected, but has been around somebody that has been diagnosed as with COVID. they get tested, they come back negative. How soon after that test comes in can they go back to work? Or what is, I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, they should be quarantined, self-quarantined for 14 days if they have close association with a known infected COVID-19 infected case. And the reason is because there's so much of the silent transmission and so many people are asymptomatic. So a test on one day doesn't mean that in 6 hours it won't turn positive, or a day or two even, or maybe it could turn positive the next day without them ever becoming symptomatic. But that it's, if we did this really well, and this is a message, if we did this really well with rapid testing, isolation and quarantine, and self-isolating the exposed people, it would be gone in between 14 and 28 days. Gone from our populace. And the reason is because it wouldn't be any transmission. That's an idealized state. We don't have enough testing equipment to do all the required testing like I just described. But you understand that we're not talking about. And then there'd always be influx of people from Missouri and places like that. I'm joking. I live in Missouri and in Topeka. So there'd always be an influx of cases coming from other outside places as well. But it's that profoundly effective, and the testing and rapid turnaround tests, isolation and quarantine, case finding, and really that's the essence of it.
So my last question then, if nobody else has any, would be, how are we going to be able to tell the difference between the flu and COVID?
Well, they're going to stick a swab up your nose and tell you.
Okay.
Let me state that just a little differently. The CDC is coming out with a swab that'll at the same time do influenza A, influenza B, and COVID-19. Now, the question, we don't have that yet. And so the real question, and this is Dr. Lee Norman talking, is if we do that swab on you because you feel like crap, it's 102 fever, coughing, et cetera. And a lot of times what's going to happen is it's going to come out and it'll be negative for influenza A and influenza B. The question is whether that COVID-19 test will be instantly known to you, or whether it's going to go back to the earlier question, which is it takes a while for it to come in. So what's going to happen then is if I test you, you have no influenza A or B, I'll put you on an anti-flu medicine like Tamiflu, and I'll still tell you, you feel like crap, go home, and we'll get you the test result. There's going to be a lot of Tamiflu going out the door, and people put on it, because we even do that now. If we think somebody's highly likely for influenza A or B, we'll put them on Tamiflu, even if the initial test is negative, because sometimes the initial test will come back negative. So there is it requires a little bit of smarts to think through this, what I would call a diagnostic and treatment algorithm. But hopefully that answers your question.
It did. Thank you. I think there was one other question I saw pop up here.
How many false negative tests? Remember that, good question. The rapid tests, the Abbott and Cepheid, there's a couple different ones. It's like you saw that in the White House about a month ago, there was all the discussion. Some of those rapid tests, and this goes back to your earlier question, Tom, is it up to 50% false negative. So if I have somebody that I think has COVID-19 and I test them with a rapid test, the 15-minute Abbott, and it's negative, I will still always send off the PCR test, which is the one from the deep in the nasopharynx, because it has a false negative rate that's almost zero. I think a glimmer of optimism, wouldn't that be nice, is that there are some really good things that are being developed on, for example, saliva testing that I think will be as sensitive, and but we're just not quite there yet. This coronavirus has been a bugger to deal with. It's you know, it's back to the earlier question about finances. People, when the SARS went away abruptly in 2003-04, then it became no longer a financially viable from a, you know, profitability perspective. Nobody wanted to invest money in it because after all, it went bye-bye. So that's why we find ourselves behind on the vaccine development. That's, and that's true with the exception of a few groups, one of which is in Oxford, England, that is far ahead of everybody else. And they're doing their best. They're sharing proprietary information with other companies to try to speed up the development. So there's a lot of noble efforts. Question here, will it be your treatment or vaccine? I don't think the vaccine's going to be here for probably another 14 months. I hope I'm wrong. Treatment, we have a steroid that can be used now that seems to be beneficial, and this remdesivir, which is an antiviral originally developed for Ebola, that may shorten the hospital stay, maybe lowers the death rate. But both of those treatments are used in critically ill people, and that would be helpful for hospitals that are getting overrun. But it doesn't do much for the person, the other, you know, 90 to 95% who are ill, but not necessarily critically ill. Over.
What's that?
I said, I think that's all the questions.
Well, the only one that I was shocked when I heard that all of our pills were made over in China. All of our prescription drugs are made in China. Are we going to be, we, the United States, going to be really excited if China comes up with a vaccine and we would we use their vaccine, or is that a fair question?
I think that both China and India are critical to our supply chain of all pharmaceuticals and probably most vaccines. I know that the federal government is looking at ways of reappropriating our supply chain to non-Chinese producers. But a lot of the chemicals for the pharmaceuticals come out of India, and they are smacked. They're getting they're really hard hit with this. So our supply chain is very damaged. I think we need to diversify. That's kind of a blinding flash of the obvious, but we need to diversify our supply chain and probably bring back more to our own control within our own country.
Got it. Well, Mr. Secretary, I really appreciate your time this morning addressing our group. We have one of our larger committee meetings today on Zoom as opposed to an in-person meeting, and I'm sure it has a lot to do with your information on the COVID situation. And again, we appreciate your service to Kansas, to the nation, as well as your help with this COVID situation moving forward.
Okay, well, if things change, if you want me back sometime in the future, I'd be happy to do that. I could do this in my sleep.
That's, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but we appreciate that, and we'll probably take you up on that.
Okay, I'll probably sign off, okay, because I've got one more thing to do, but before 11 o'clock. So thanks, you guys.
You bet. Thank you.
You bet.
All right. We are going to take about a 2 or 3 minute break, and then we're going to go. Or Tom, do you want to do any more on the legislative stuff?
Nah, not at this point. If somebody has some questions, they can ask me. I'll do it later. I think I have quite a bit, but anyway, I don't want to bore people because you know me, I don't like to talk very much. So,
our next, we'll start back here. I want to make sure I had told everybody we wouldn't start early just because I know there are some people that wanted to bring in other people for certain speakers. So we'll start here in about a couple of minutes. Again, just to remind everybody that the chat feature is down there. You can actually use it to send everybody a question. Everybody can read it. If you would rather ask the question yourself, just let us know and we can unmute you. Or you can actually send it to myself or Tom individually. So that way, if you don't want everybody to know your question, if it's a kind of a personal question type of thing, we can ask that. You can do that as well. But other than that, I am going to, Christina is here. Our next speaker is with HR Partners here in Topeka. And I will say, I actually sat through an HR session on COVID with her and found it extremely interesting. And so she's going to talk a lot about how to handle certain situations. And I'm going to pull up her thing and let's see if we can do this. Share the right screen here. All right. Here we go. So Christina, I am going to make sure you are unmuted.
I think I'm unmuted. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm just like Dr. Norman. This isn't my first rodeo on Zoom. So let's dig in. What Becky basically just said is, I'm an HR consultant. I've been doing this 30 years. My husband is an employment attorney. And, guess what? I never thought I would put pandemic expert on my resume, but we've had to roll up our sleeves here primarily in March. And then a lot of things happened, when it comes to the law effective April 1st. So the five things that I have over here tend to be the five things that I get phone calls on when it comes to employment issues or questions about how to comply with the law now that we're basically in a COVID world. I am going to self-disclose something. I'm going to self-disclose, and I was supposed to have lunch with Tom and Becky tomorrow, but I'm on quarantine. And it's because someone at my office tested positive, and all of us, fled to the hills. I have had symptoms, and I tested on Monday, and I don't have the results back yet. So I am pretty much a lonely person on quarantine. So there you go. And I wish I was like what Dr. Norman described, that I got it via through the bars and having a good time and going out on July 4th parties. And none of that occurred. My network is tight. I literally only hang out with family and come to work. I've been very, very careful. But I think what you're going to find out is, even if you're very, very careful, the people that are around you, not so much. And God bless, when the stay-at-home order was lifted, a lot of people got out and about, and that's why we're having problems with COVID right now. So let me dig in. That first thing, the FFCRA, all you really need to know about that law is two things. Part of that law is about child care issues and people having child care issues because of this COVID crisis. And so, as crazy as this sounds, have I had a lot of issues with that with my respective clients or people that I consult with? Not so much. People did a very, very, very good job of getting respective child care, for their kids. Or they started working from home in order to make that happen. But the one that I'm getting the most questions about is the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. And what I really, really want you to do, I didn't want to do it on this Zoom call, but if you go to my website, we took a 120-page law down to 3 pages, okay? It is the best summary statement, and I'm on the phone with a lot of our clients, and I go to page 2, go to this section, and yes, they qualify, or they don't qualify for the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. Why you need to get well-versed on that is because of exactly what is happening to me. I'm on quarantine. I've been quarantined by the county just because I was in contact with someone with COVID. So as an employer, I need to know how I pay my people and how I can get reimbursed through tax credits. So FYI, take a little bit of time to go out there and get that 3-page summary. It will help you out a great deal. The second thing right there, a request for emergency paid sick leave, you need to document You need to document, and I'm doing the same thing because I've got to educate, you know, my respective CPA or accountant when it comes to getting my tax credits back. Here is when these emergency paid sick leave acts occurred. And this is what I need to get basically reimbursed for on tax credits. Here's going to be the challenge. And I've already seen this challenge. COVID really started, you know, gaining momentum in April, but then it's gone to a whole nother level here in July. And I've had people quarantine twice. And that law is only for one quarantine or one 80-hour period. So I'm seeing challenges with how do we compensate these people, you know, basically after they've exhausted their 80 hours of legal leave. So, you know, we can talk a little bit more about that. There's no magic answer in here. And I don't think when Congress passed this law that they thought that people would have to use it multiple times. But it's pretty easy to use it multiple times when you're particularly out and about or in an essential employee with an essential employer. And so we got to talk a little bit more about that. Number three, out there on our website, most of the clients that I've worked with have already done this when they basically got back into the office, is to have a guide on how to do that properly. Now I'm going to tell you, with our office, we're a small office. We only have 5 employees in our respective office. And if I were to do anything differently, and if I were to be honest with you, how I probably potentially got COVID is the common areas, meaning the coffee pot, the conference room, the bathroom. And we thought we had a good cleanliness policy, but I think we needed to put it up a notch. And I'm not gonna lie, what Governor Kelly put out there, as well as our respective county and Shawnee County, is when you're in common areas within your workforce, you should be wearing a mask. And guess what? When I am in my office right now, but I literally came in the building with a mask on, came to my office, shut the door. I'm doing this respective call, and then I'm leaving. I'm getting out of here. I'm not touching anything within the common areas because my test is still pending, and I don't know if I'm a hit or not. So you should go out to that guide and really think through not only what we have put together, but what has recently come out, you know, from our respective governor as well as our county agencies when it comes to common areas and the mask. The fourth one, I've been asked by a lot of clients because of they want a general policy on infectious disease. And that, you know, can be something that you can put in your employee handbook. So don't feel bad about, you know, taking that particular template and using it. You need to have something that you basically communicate with your staff in regards to what the rules are and what the policy is. And then last but not least, probably the biggest buzzkill that has occurred with this COVID is it's really cut down on vacations. You cannot travel to certain, you know, respective states. And just like Dr. Norman said, it's really fun when the state of Kansas gets on their list. I saw that New York doesn't want any of us to come see them. Guess what? Isn't that fun? But long story short, you need to have readily available to you the KDHE's, you know, link to travel restrictions, and really you need to educate your workforce that I'm all for vacations, but they can't go on vacation to a respective hotspot. And that's why we have it, you know, out there to basically educate people that they're going into a COVID world. Now, that That particular declaration form is something that you can use with your respective staff to have that open dialogue about their travel. Usually I have two different types of travel that I'm dealing with. I'm dealing with, travel within the state, or you have to travel for your job, and then traveling, you know, for personal reasons. But it's just an open dialogue that you need to have with your respective staff in regards to the boundaries of, you know, what is going on in the world and what are hot spots. Consider, because you have to quarantine if you come back from a respective hotspot. Okay, I went through that real quick. So, does anybody have questions? Do you want me to read these, Becky? Okay. Let's see if I can get this in front of me.
Okay. First question is, how can we find the states that Kansas has on their hit list?
I don't know. I just heard that I heard it on the national news about Kansas being on New York's respective website. So I think the only way you can know is you'd have to go to every individual state and see who they have listed, as you cannot travel. I don't know if there's a consolidated place to look.
Charlie, you asked that question. Charlie, I can look and see if I can find something here in a little bit, and I will post it on the chat box.
Yeah, that would be interesting to find out. I've never had that question, but that's a good question.
So, Christina, one of the things that we had talked about at a previous meeting is how you handle work from home situations with some of your employees. I know a lot of our members on this call, some of them have, you know, employees that are in management roles or can work from home, and then some people that can't, some people that don't work well from home. Like, how do you do that within your company when you have multiple ways of doing that?
That's a good question. And we have started developing, or we have developed, is telecommuting policies as well as telecommuting agreements. And at the end of the day, you know, if you have someone working from home, you need to have some level of documentation in regards to what your expectations are. And usually what the expectations are involve some level of productivity, as well as I know when we first did a little bit of work from home, if I email you or I text you, I'd like to hear back from you like today. You know, so a lot of it is response time, you know, so you need to put together those expectations. The other thing that seems to be a big deal with telecommuting is you have given your property, whether it's computers, cell phones, etc., you need to have an open dialogue if anything happens or the relationship is severed, how you get those respective, you know, property back. The other question you just had, Becky, is what about, not everybody can work from home. Not everybody can work from home. So guess what? You're going to have that open dialogue in regards to who can work from home and who cannot. What a lot of successful companies have done is they still are having people come into the office, but they're rotating people in and out. Not the full group is there at one time. So everybody has some in the office time, and then some are having out of the office time. But I will say, now that the stay at home has been lifted, what's been challenging is I've dealt with a lot more COVID hits in the last 2 weeks than I have in the last 3 months. It's like wildfire right now. So that's the problem and just like Dr. Norman said, it's going and it's going, but I agree with him as well too. Businesses cannot shut down. We need to keep moving and grooving, and we got to figure out a way. And I just wish we had better testing. That would be optimum. Just like me, I took a test and they said it will take 5 days to get my results. 5 days. That's a long time to get results back. So
you don't appear to have any symptoms.
It's funny. I do. But this is the one I know. And what's interesting is when I called Stormont Vail and said, hey, I've been exposed and I wanted to test then. And they said, we will not test you unless you have symptoms. And by the way, my symptoms are so mild. I mean, in any other circumstance or any other world, if it wasn't a COVID world, Tom, I'd be, you know, buck up, buttercup, and go to work. But since it's a COVID world, my mild symptoms are contagious. So I have to chill out. But you're right. I don't really feel bad. It's an inconvenience, my symptoms, but nothing that is taking me down. So
what are some of the businesses like top, what are you seeing as some of the issues they're having with either the, and you touched on a little bit with the emergency paid sick leave or anything like that?
I think the biggest issue is, and it's with every COVID hit I get is, you know, depending on the business, how many people were around that person now that they're a COVID hit? I mean, if they don't organize this in such a way and they don't quarantine people as quickly as possible, it can spread pretty quickly. So that's the biggest challenge that I have right now is once a COVID hit occurs is how to manage through it. They don't always know how to manage through it. I know this sounds awful, but the other thing I've had to deal with is liar, liar, pants on fire. People have taken advantage of this time and they will call into their employer and say, oh, I was exposed. I need a 14-day quarantine with zero documentation. You know, and I, now that I've been through this myself, oh my God, they throw documentation at you. Every step of the process, they know that employers are asking for it. So they just give it to you whether you want it or not. So if someone comes to you and says, oh, I've been exposed or, oh, you know, there's documentation. You can ask for that. And that's the other thing. Employers are scared to ask questions. And by the way, this is the one time in employment history that I've ever seen employers have a lot of rights and a lot of power. So I tell people to use it. And I can send you the respective documentation. Even you can require people to test. You can require it. It's kind of like drug testing. You know, you can't come back unless you do X, Y, Z, P, D, and Q. So that's the other thing is a lot of people don't understand their rights. But hey, here's the good news. If you don't understand it, you probably are not going through it right now. But if you go through it, you need to get educated that you do have a lot of power.
Does that, providing that documentation, violate HIPAA at all? Are there any HIPAA concerns with that?
No, that's a good question. The only time legally that you have to inform your respective staff if there's a positive hit, positive, but you cannot disclose who it is, which is entertaining because wouldn't you love a phone call? Hey, we had a positive hit, but we're not going to tell you who it is. And so, like I said, what I've seen happen, which whether we could have a debate on it, is people's HIPAA rights, you know, in regards to telling or not telling. But you don't have to tell anybody if you, you know, are like in the category of myself, where I'm just self-disclosing because that's just the way I am. But legally, I don't have to do that. The only time you legally have to disclose if there's a positive hit. Positive.
If we're hiring somebody, Christina, can we ask that question? Have you had COVID or are you?
That's a good question. And yes, you have a lot of rights in regards to that as well too. But the questions you ask are not like, have you had COVID? You know, those questions you get asked, have you been blah, blah, blah in the last 14 days? You can ask those questions.
Okay.
You can ask those. So there is specific questions you can ask, but not like point blank. Have you had COVID? you know, and when did you have COVID? But I laugh. But no, there are some magic questions.
Well, that makes total sense to me. It's a yes or no answer.
I wish it would be a lot easier.
Oh my.
I know. Any other questions?
I have one in a text message here. It says, is there a certain type of quarantine for an essential business? Not for a positive tested person, but for someone. So if somebody's been in contact with somebody that's been tested positive, is there a certain quarantine or anything like that that someone in an essential business would have to follow, you know?
If you're an essential business, there's guidelines out on the CDC what you have to do. What usually happens is if you've been exposed and you're an essential employee, you get tested immediately. And if you have no symptoms, you go back to work right away. But you have to wear PPE. You have to wear a mask. You have to blah, 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 blah. So that's the key.
Cool.
And I could do that. I'm deemed, you know, by the state as an essential employer because of what I do. But I do have a job that I can work from home because I don't want to be wearing a mask all the time. I'm going to be candid with you. And I have that, you know, freedom to work from home. But if I had to work here on a regular basis, then I'd have to wear a mask. I'd have to wear the PPE. Good question.
Can we, I'm on your website.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. At the FFCRA, can I publish that to any of my people?
Absolutely. No? Absolutely. It's like I said, it's the best thing that our lawyers did for us because I'm going to be candid with you. It's still got the legalese in it. I mean, but it's a summary. And, you know, at the end of the day, none of us want to go through 120 pages of the FFR, you know, CRA. So, and that's what most employers want to know is what are their rights and how do I pay people appropriately? So.
Okay. Before we leave, I'm going to unmute everybody because I know there's a few people that are on phone calls only and see if anybody has any other questions. So I'm making a lot of background noise. But if it's
my sheet,
question, I'll let him ask.
Real quick. My two, we're giving you more money. 4568 and 46.
More. So how did we produce more?
And now I will mute everybody again. So the other question, there was one more question. Christina, if you don't mind sharing, what symptoms are you having that prompted you to be able to go get tested? Oh, whoops, hold on, I muted you. There we
okay.
Go.
Okay, my symptoms. First, it was a headache. I had a headache, but it was continual, and I don't get headaches very often. And it wasn't severe, it wasn't like a migraine, just a nuisance. Then the second thing that I had was a sore throat. It wasn't like a strep throat, but you could tell that it wasn't quite normal. My third symptom, it's called diarrhea. So there you go. And then last but not least, I walk every morning and I tried to walk yesterday and I walked about a mile and I had a tightness in my chest. Mm. So that was the final straw that I said, okay, these other things were inconvenient, but that's not normal. And so I went and tested immediately. Now, what's funny about this story is my father went and tested too. Like I said, my circle is very tight. And my dad, who is a retired dentist, he tried to warn me how bad the test was, you know, that shoving up the, and I thought, you know, okay, dad, how bad can it be? You know, a little swab. Oh no. It is literally like everybody says, it is very, icky. I could go on and on, but I'm glad I did it. And by the way, here in our community, it's a drive-through. So you call Stormont Vail, they make decisions on whether or not you should be tested. and then they give you an appointment to drive through, and you drive through, and now I'm waiting for the results. And my father has had very, very few symptoms too. He has had, same thing, headache. He had headaches, and he had the chills. I have not had a fever. I have not had a fever. So I think, and a lot of the COVID hits that I've worked with, rarely do people have fevers, rarely. So I haven't had that. So good question.
Tom, anything else?
No, there's another question up on the board.
Oh. I've had a couple of my employees at a convenience store tested positive, and the county quarantined all of my employees, even though we were essential. Should I have challenged the county on the 3/4 of my staff that never developed symptoms?
That's a good question. Yes, I would have done that, particularly being an essential employer. I had another essential employer where the county shut them down for 2 days, but the reason they shut them down for 2 days was to test everybody and to make determinations in regards to, how to transition back into the workplace. So, I mean, I will say, just like Dr. Norman said, you need to work with your respective health department, and they will work with you to get you back up to speed. But sometimes you have to challenge and say, can we go to plan B or plan C? Because I have found out not everybody there has COVID. A percentage does, but not everybody. So can we test? Can we do something?
We have, and unfortunately, we have some counties that aren't as helpful as others. But we have one employee, another comment here, that she said she challenged the county and didn't get anywhere. No one tested positive besides the one individual, and they were all wearing masks. So
interesting. I'm surprised. But I've seen the county do that. And, it does depend on the respective county. It does. And I think a lot of it, and that's the one thing Dr. Norman talked about, half of what I deal with is the physical part of COVID, but most of it is the fear factor and the lack of facts. And I think that's what's bad, even with my situation, is at the end of the day, I want facts. I mean, I still don't know if I have it or not. I mean, and a lot of people are like me that are out there that don't have any facts. So what's been difficult about this, the most difficult, is I'm all about facts and not feelings. I am so into that. But this pandemic has been more about the feelings and not the facts. And, you know, it's been very difficult to run businesses at this time because, the health department, they will say quarantine everybody. Well, that sounds great, just saying quarantine everybody. But, at the end of the day, we've got to pay people. We've got to support people. And so that's the challenge. I'm not going to lie. And there's no easy answers.
So when you get the phone call tomorrow says you are negative, does that mean you're going to stay home because you're still sick, or you're going to go back to work?
I think what Dr. Norman said is, I should not be coming back to the office if I'm still having any level of symptoms, even if I test negative. And what I've read, and in fact, the documentation, Tom, that Stormont Vail gave me is, do not come back to work until you've had 72 hours of symptom-free.
Oh.
After, so symptom-free. And I'm not there yet. So even if I get it back and it says negative, then I still got to get out of the symptom zone.
Stay at home and work.
Yeah, correct.
Good.
So, yeah.
Any other questions from anybody? I've almost heard all I want to hear about COVID for the last hour, 2 hours.
I know. Believe me, when I get home, that's the last thing I want to hear about. So, you're feeling my pain, Tom.
Well, I tell all my friends the reason why I'm not sick, I drink a lot of scotch. And nobody likes scotch. So.
Well, I'm not going to deny that is helpful. Jen has kind of gotten me through this as well, but I will say, you know, we're all human and we can only go so far. If I do have this and I get through it, maybe I'll have some level of superpower immunity, but they don't even know about that. They don't know if you can get this again. So I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot.
Well, we really appreciate your time and your expertise, and we really hope that you are negative.
Yeah.
And that you get feeling better soon so that you can take me to lunch.
I will do that. I will do that. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Christina.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We have about 5 minutes, and I know we've been going for an hour. So in true committee meeting, in-person meeting, we're going to take a five-minute break so everybody can go to the bathroom, refresh their beverages and stuff. And when we come back, then Gary Davenport with the KCC is going to go over the new hours of service for our trucks, and then answer some of if you have questions on transportation. So we'll start him at 11:15, so everybody can take a quick break, and we'll be back.
And do you want to open it up and
let I will unmute all, and we can hear everybody's
conversation. No.
We're going to hear Susie's conversation.
Yeah. Okay.
Tuesday. Probably everything but Tallulah. Okay. Actually, I think he speaks tonight too. All right. So he has, I just realized, his 24-hour store.
What is his store?
130-15 State Line, State Line in KCMO. He has a BP. He has a BP in Kansas at
Is he the corner store on the state line?
Yeah.
Right there in his, he has a little
car wash.
Car wash plus it's a tiny store.
Yeah.
And then he had a little van comes outside his store and sells food.
Yeah.
I didn't have that, but that store every day.
You should eat there.
From the truck?
Yes. Mediterranean.
Okay, I'll stop.
Oh my God, it's delicious.
Okay, so he that store is 24 hours.
Yeah.
Some state. Yeah, that's on Kansas, Missouri.
Which one's that?
So I think we should try and talk to him about, but the only difference is he's a BP. My other guy, Kareem, has never had a 24-hour store. So I am thinking, Jim, Jubilee Market, you're just going to have to leave.
What's your question?
Okay, I'm going to take that call anymore.
Do you have a phone? Sandra said, "What's your question?" So I said, "Do you have a phone?"
Okay. All right. Gary, I'm trying to unmute you, so.
How's that?
There we go. And then let's see if I can share my screen.
We ready to go?
Yeah, I'm trying to get his presentation up here just a second.
Okay.
All right. In order for me to be able to do both things, I'm gonna share the right screen here. Okay. There we go. And everybody should be able to see Gary's screen, and then Gary, what we'll do is whenever you're ready to move on, just let me know and we can do that. So
sounds good.
For everybody that's on the phone, we have Gary Davenport, who's the assistant deputy director for transportation at the Kansas Corporation Commission. So he's going to talk about the hours of service, and then we can answer some questions. So Gary, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Becky. I have this opening slide, and I found these slides, and I don't know if you want to share with your members or not. That's fine. It came from the Fed's website, and it does a concise job of putting the regulations out. I am going to not go over the preliminary stuff of why they did it. I would like to just jump directly to the short haul provision, but these rules do go into effect on September the 29th. And the short haul provision is really something I think that will help your membership a great deal, because it changed there's no differentiation between a non-CDL and a CDL vehicle after these rules go into effect. So basically what happens is the CDL vehicles will then have 150 air mile radius, which is a pretty big area. You know, you're looking at almost a 300 mile diameter when you look at the 150, but then you also have to take into account that that's actually 172.6 statute miles. So you draw a line out 172.6 miles. That's a big area there. And you've got the 150 air miles plus you're extended to the 14 hours. And while they put the 12 hour restriction on in the first place, I don't know, but this was a good move, and it will help a lot of short haul provision people. You still have to remember the basics, though. You have to return to your work reporting location at the end of the day, and that's critical. And you have to be within, obviously, the 12 hours and 150 air mile radius. If any of those three things are not accomplished, then you would have to log that day. So if you had a day that you're not going to make it back at the end of the day, you're going to have a layover someplace, you would have to log that particular day, but then you could go back on to your short haul provision once you're able to meet the three criteria of returning to the work reporting location, the 150 air miles, and the 14 hours. It is important, though, when you are doing these and you're using the short haul provision, and actually, I will mention you can use a logbook to note the short haul provision. There are no guidances on what you have to use for documentation, but you have to have three things that are important and my investigators will look for when we come out and do a compliance review. And that is, we're going to want to see obviously the day, but we want to see the start time and the end time. Because the 14 hours, it's 14 clock hours. So if you start at 6 o'clock in the morning, if you're not done at 8 o'clock that night, you better be logging, or we will show you a violation. But you need to keep the start time, the end time, and the total hours worked. So we start at 6 a.m. and we finish at 8 p.m. But did we work that entire time? You know, if your driver took an hour off for lunch, then obviously they're going to say we started at 6, got off at 8 p.m., and we worked 11 hours where we worked, in that case, 13 hours. So that is the only real difference, but I think it'll be a big help for your industry with the trucks. And we can go to the next slide then. And it does give you some good illustrations on here. The this is going to just reconfirm what I just said. You have to operate within 150 air miles and not exceed your 14 hours, and that is clock hours and start and end the shift at each location. The passenger vehicle, you don't have to worry about that. But you still, the property drivers, which you guys are, you do have to have the 10 hours off between each short haul provision that you have. We can go to the next one. And, you know, like I said, you aren't required to fill out anything. You can use an ELD for this. I mean, it's in your trucks, it's an easy way to take care of your time. Your drivers didn't have to do anything, and you've got it documented there. And you don't have to worry about trying to fudge. But you're going to have the same deal. You're going to have your last 7 days, because the 60 and 70 hour rule is still applies in this situation, even if you're using the short haul. Because basically all the short haul is doing is exempting you from having to complete a logbook, or what they call record of duty status. And you can just keep it as a time card. But another key thing is, if your driver is using the short haul provision, he does not have to show that to the enforcement on a roadside inspection. You can just, your drivers would need to just say, you know, I'm on the short haul provision. If you want those time records, you can contact my employer and they can provide that for you. And like it said, you know, said when you no longer meet the exception, then you have to log that. So if you're on an ELD, it's already doing that for you anyway. The problem is now that you're at 14 hours, once you go over that 14 hours, if you're actually driving at that point in time, you're going to be in violation anyway, because the rules are based on the 14-hour restriction. And we can go to the next slide there, Becky. Adverse driving conditions. It's kind of interesting. We just finished listening about COVID, and we just got another note from the Fed's FMCSA yesterday regarding the adverse driving conditions. And they've changed it a little bit. And one of the big changes is initially the adverse driving condition was they gave you an extra 2 hours to drive. But then you didn't have any extra hours on the clock. And what this does is it gives extra hours for that. And they did add some things to what is a adverse driving condition. And the note we got yesterday was, because of it's not COVID, but it's the protest. What does your driver do if he's driving through someplace and they're having a protest and they block the roads? They need to document it, and you know, we will check it out. We'll, if we come in and do an investigation and we see that you've documented that you had a adverse driving condition, you need to note that and tell what happened and give the dates and stuff, because the investigators will verify that that did happen. You know, but it's something to help. You know, and I won't even go into what do you do. I mean, I saw the video just like everybody else of the tanker driver that made a mistake. He didn't even know the road was shut down, and they took him out and they beat him up. And so unfortunate. You know, people don't understand, you know, how essential trucking really is, especially here's a guy doing his job, and you know, and they don't realize how dangerous that truck was. I mean, if we had had an explosion, we would have had a few less protesters at that point in time, because that would not have been a pretty scene. But that's what the change in the adverse driving conditions is. You know, so that would be if you have a weather or a highway condition that you're, and they did change a little bit, because previously it said none of which were apparent on the basis of information known to the person dispatching the run at the time it was begun. So that left it up upon the shoulders of the dispatcher to determine. Now it says that were not known or could not reasonably have been known to the driver or the motor carrier. So that changed a little bit, but it's still, it's a common sense rule. You know, it's trying to protect the driver, give him additional time if there's something that comes up that he wouldn't know about. So you go to the next slide, and I believe it gives some illustrations of that for what you can have. So you can see the 2 hours applies to both the driving time and the on-duty time. And we can go to the next one. And so here's an example of a driver. He left and he's got an hour out and he's got to stop because of something that came up on the road. And it, again, the big thing is documentation. And with ELDs, for using an ELD system, it has a good way to annotate what's going on and give any details that need to just to justify what you're doing. And then we can go on to the next one, because I'm sure if people have questions, they can ask when we get done with this. 30-minute break. Now, the 30-minute break, if you're taking the short-haul provision, the 30-minute break does not apply to you, so you don't have to worry about that. But the 30-minute break requirement did make a change, and basically what that is they before it had to be off duty or sleeper berth. Now it just has to be a break, and it also is a break after a total of 8 hours of driving. In the past, or originally, it was after 8 hours and you were driving, you have to take a 30-minute break. Now it's 8 hours of driving. After you've driven for a total of 8 hours, you need to have at least a 30-minute break. But that could be on duty, not driving. That could be fueling a truck. You know, it's basically, the idea is when you're driving that far and that long, you have a tendency to get hypnotized by the road. You may get a little lackadaisical. It just takes some time to get your blood pumping back from just sitting there. And having been there and done that, I understand, and I think it's not a bad idea. And we can go to the next one. And this is just showing the different ways that you could log the 30-minute break. As in the past, it had to be off-duty or sleeper. Now it could be an on-duty time. And that's why I think it's important to make these slides available to your members so they can see these illustrations of the examples of that. And we can go to the next one. And the sleeper berth provisions, I don't know if a lot of your people, very few of them are going to use sleeper berths. But again, I think this was a good move because it at least allows to go to a 7-3 split also. I know when my wife and I drove together, we always did 5-5 and that worked fine with us, but that was back in the 10-hour break day. So, you know, this is a good move, I think. And it does, you know, keep you limited on your hours. You have to really watch it though, because if you have somebody that tries to use the sleeper berth provision and they aren't paying attention, they can get in trouble. Even with an ELD, you know, if they're not watching their screens. Because I know back when I was driving at Frito back in 1987 when we were doing the pilot program for it, I was bebopping down eastern Missouri, going down towards Cape Girardeau, and checked my screen, and oh, lo and behold, I'd been on duty for 14 and a half hours, and I was still driving. So I, at that time, it was 15 hours, but you know, I was over, and so I got a violation from the company, and I got a little note that said, you know, slap on the wrist time. You know, don't do this again. So, you know, you can, if you don't pay attention to what you're doing, you can get in trouble with that. And we can go to the next slide. And these are just some illustrations on the sleeper berth provisions. And I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on that. It's just simply showing a 7-3 split or an 8-2. And so we can go to the next one. And the compliance date, it takes effect September 29th. Now, I do know that there are some safety advocacy groups. As in all change of hour service rules, they always go and they they tried to get a hold on it. I don't foresee any changes in the September 29th date. And quite honestly, I think from what I've seen, these are a good common sense changes and updates to the hours of service rules. And you don't always hear that about, government doing something that made sense. But I think this one really did. And so that basically is the real changes. You've got a deal where you can go on the FMCSA's website. You can go to our website. Here's a book we put out, and this is on our website. It's Safety Procedures for Safety and Compliance. And it's on PDF, and you can make copies of it. But it's at our website at kcc.ks.gov. And when you go onto that website, if you go to the transportation link, and that's going to be indicated by, you've got a button there with red, green, and yellow tractor, trailer combinations. But we have a lot of information. We have the KCC regs. We have this procedures book on there. And the procedures book has all the forms that companies need for compliance. And one of the things with all the COVID going on, Kansas is the only state that has had weekly safety meetings, and we haven't had weekly safety meetings. We got bumped out on that because of the COVID stuff. So we're waiting. I thought originally we could get going again on June 22nd. That did not work. And now we're looking at potentially in August starting our classes again. But again, you've got to look at the protocol and what's going on. And it seems like the COVID restrictions and criteria changes on a daily basis, so it's hard to keep up with it. But we are still, and some people have asked, why don't we do something like this? Why don't we do a Zoom meeting? Well, a Zoom meeting for different groups is going to be difficult. And when you have a 4-hour safety meeting, it's difficult to make sure that people are really paying attention and the information we are providing is important. One thing that the different challenges that we have today with the COVID and the protests is that you have people that are a lot more distracted. You have people that may have mental health issues. I've seen more suicides by truck. It's just things that people need to, be aware of. And that way, prepare their drivers. I mean, trucking obviously is an essential activity. Our investigators have been working. We took our 2-week mandatory governor admin leave time, but since then we've all been working full time. And we are kind of at a luxury because all 10 of our safety investigators are working offsite anyway. They're at home, so they don't have to meet with anybody. And when we go out and we conduct a compliance review, it will be offsite, and it will be comprehensive because we will check all your different basics. And so it will all be done online. We'll inform you that you've been selected. And so we're still following up on all the carriers that we have in the past. Now, obviously, we have some challenges because of the COVID restrictions and exemptions. And one of the exemptions, I didn't think tankers would be now involved in the exemptions for the safety rules and regulations. But I was contacted by one of my investigators this morning, and he was out doing roadside inspections up in Belleville yesterday. And he got halfway through the inspection, and then the driver said, oh, this is a COVID-related move. He says, I'm taking this is alcohol. I'm taking it down to Oklahoma to be used as a sanitizing agent for the COVID stuff. So it would have been nice to know up front, because he just spent 20 minutes doing an inspection and found out he's exempt from everything we do anyway. So that, but those are some additional challenges that we have with the investigators. But I do know that it seems like we've had an uptick in fatal crashes involving CMVs. And, you know, I will say that, you know, if anybody's out there and you're involved in one, most of the time it's the other truck, or it's a lot of cars. And it goes back down to the distracted driving. And I don't know if it's caused because of the COVID. I don't know if it's caused because people are thinking about the protests. I don't know if it's a mental issue or what. But we're seeing an uptick in fatalities. And we do go in, if there's a fatal crash in Kansas, and it's a Kansas carrier, we will go out and do a compliance review on that carrier to make sure that all their safety things are in place. And that's protection for the carrier and everybody involved. So we have good trucks and safe drivers out there. So, I do want to mention, you know, the rules, the hours of service rules, they are a federal rule change. And so the question would come in, what about Kansas? Because the Kansas Highway Patrol can only enforce what the KCC puts in place. And we have right now, it's down with the Rules and Reg Committee, we have an emergency rule adoption request with them so that it can be put in place by September 29th on an emergency basis. And it also has been written in, we do a update on our regulations, and you can catch those if you go to that safety information, the guy with the red shirt thumbs up. If you go in there, you can see the KCC safety rules and regulations. And we adopt and update those. We try to do it a lot, but when you have to go through the Department of Administration and the Attorney General and the Budget Office now, it's a long process because one kicks it out because it didn't meet their muster. So you have to go through all three agencies again. And so we used to take about a year. Now it takes about 2 years, but we did just get the most recent ones in, and they're in place. So with that,
there's one question, Gary, in the queue, and then okay. I have a couple for you. Suppose a driver is doing fine on time and then goes to load his last load and encounters a wait of an additional hour wait time. Would that be considered adverse traffic conditions, since we don't know if the wait time is going to be 15 minutes or 2 hours? And I mean, I think that's about everywhere, the inconsistent wait time.
And that is a great question. And the answer is that is not an adverse condition because the terminal, you knew it was full anyway. And that is a time when, you know, I know we've worked with you guys in the past on getting an exemption from the hours of service because of the wait times at the terminals so that the drivers can go. Now, I think a lot of your people are going to be delivering at the convenience stores, and there shouldn't be any problems unless there's a protest. And then you would have an adverse driving condition because you can't get to the location because a protest is going on in that location.
Okay. I have a question on the Drug and Alcohol Clearinghouse. How is that going? Does it seem to be going well, or should all of our people be using it right now, or are they still having problems with it?
It's like any federal program. It takes a while to work the bugs out. And it is up and running. And we just, also on that safety information page, when we go in and do a compliance review, there are certain violations that we will penalize for. And we update the penalty matrix every year. It is posted on there. And it's also, if you look up there and you see the records and information, it's in there also when the precedent and guidance documents, if you go to it, and then it would be in the, you go down to the, let me see, they've got all of them, keep going. It's down towards the bottom on that, Becky. There, the guidance document right there. And they just actually were updated. And one of the violations we do penalize for is not being signed into the clearinghouse. So it's important to get into the clearinghouse. If you've got CDL, work on getting in there. And I know a lot of the difficulties initially were, they were just flooded when they finally opened it up. But I think they've got most of those bugs worked out.
What's coming? Is there anything that FMCSA is proposing? Like, was there anything that we all need to be concerned or investigating about? Or any new rulemakings that are out there?
I'm not aware of anything that's going to have an impact at this point in time. You know, and this is, you know, with the current administration, they want to get rid of regulations anyway. And so you're not going to see a lot of additional things made, and there's no, you haven't had any tragic accidents that would justify saying, hey, we've got an issue here that needs to be regulated. So at this point in time, I really don't see anything on the horizon, but it's like anything else. It could change tomorrow. And so we're in unpredictable times.
Very true. Does anybody have any other questions? For Gary?
They want to go to lunch.
Yeah, they got one more speaker first.
Oh, okay.
So, well, if there's no other questions, thank you, Gary, for your time. I truly appreciate it. And everybody, I will have his presentation and send it out to everybody once we get done here. So,
I think we might be able to put that on the website. Along with that Christina stuff too, so you can put that word out. Gary, thank you very much. That information
is helpful. Appreciate it. You bet, Tom. Good to see you.
Good to see you too.
Take care. Yeah. All right.
Bye.
Bye.
One other thing we are going to start doing here at PMCA, for those of you still on that have trucks, we are going to work on, and I'm trying to find the document for me real quick here. We're going to start doing some compliance checks and helping out with your files, things like that. It's a service that PMCA used to offer many years ago, and we're going to start kicking that off again. So if you are interested, and I know I've talked with Charlie Robinson about this, if you are interested in having us come out and go through your files, we will send out a sheet for you that kind of talks about what services that we're going to be able to offer to you. But a lot of that is, and I'm, you know, some of you know my background is in the record keeping and stuff, and, you know, that's how I actually got started with PMCA. But to do mock audits and then just kind of go through your files and see what we have, whether it's their driver's files, your maintenance files, medical files, and then, of course, getting you set up for the drug and alcohol clearinghouse. We started on some of that, and then the site kind of went crazy, I guess, and it wasn't working real well. So we have several levels that we can do that just to kind of help you guys out and see how your files are doing. We know that audits don't happen very often, but you never know when an accident could happen or a crash, and that's when you will see, of course, an auditor come out if you have a severe enough crash. So you want to make sure everything is in order. So we will provide a bunch of those services. The other part of this is last year we launched at this time a partnership with a company, I'm trying to think what they're called. ProTread is what I know them as, but doing safety programs online. And they have been releasing a lot of new modules. But if you are interested in that service, let me know, because we have lots of lots of presentations that they will, that they are producing right now to add to their services. So that is a service that you can sign up to do some of your safety training, things like that. And Patrick says he just signed up with ProTread. Patrick, can I unmute you real quick? And so you can talk about it a little bit, maybe. Patrick, there you are.
I muted, okay.
There you go.
Well, that's some of the things that we're looking at is the procedures and policies and operations that we have in place that, you know, we touch on a lot of things, but we were weak on documentation. We were concerned if Gary Davenport were to walk in our door and said, okay, show me this. What have you done? Say, well, Gary, I've been doing this for 35 years. We're okay on this. Well, that's not good enough. prove to me that you've got this handled. And that's why we went out to ProTread and work with those guys and set through their demo and exactly for those reasons that we now have an online source that can document all the testing and policies and review and document that our drivers have gone through all those procedures and policies. So yeah, that was the reason why we did that, just to kind of take that piece away from our inability to get to it and have another policy or group out there to document that and keep that resource of information out there.
Awesome. Well, and you know, the other part of this, let me see if I can share my screen again here. The other part of this that we are looking at is to help with some of that policy, making. I will say that I may have taken some policies from my former employer and can modify those a little bit to fit, you know, your needs as that's basically what we need. I mean, obviously none of you want the policies that have anywhere else. So that is something that we can help with as well. And Charlie, to answer your question, I don't believe, and Patrick, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe they'll manage your files. There are other companies out there that will do that, but ProTread is more of the training scheduling and making sure your drivers have the proper, like your hazmat or your human trafficking training and things like that, and other just safety training.
That's the way I understand it, correct?
Yeah. But there are other companies out there that will manage your files for you. JJ Keller has a program. It's not real great. It's easy to use, but it's not real great. There's a couple of others out there, and I'd have to get you their names, that do a pretty good job at managing all your files and things like that. There's actually even some companies that will run all of your background checks and monitor your driver's licenses to make sure that they have their medical cards tied to it and things like that. So those are some things that hopefully we can get posted on our website and get going, so that way you have those more documents of things that you can use. So,
super.
Any other questions that we have on transportation? Tom, do you have anything?
I don't. Let's see. Oh, I think you've got the questions already answered that were on the board. No, and I know that our next speaker is at 12, and I don't see him on.
He is on.
Oh, he is?
Yep. I think I just admitted him. Yep, he's there.
So if Bob's ready to go, then let's have the KDHE do an update of the UST regs, and since they've just been approved in Kansas.
I got to get him unmuted. I unmute you there, Bob. I think.
Okay, there I think I'm unmuted.
There you are.
I'm trying to do this where I can control the PowerPoint with my laptop and the other parts on our video board. So we're going to see how this goes. Worst case scenario, I'll get off the video board and just use the laptop.
I was going to say, I can always run your PowerPoint if you want me to.
That's up to you, I think.
Here we go. I think that I can, we'll make you the host there, Bob, and then you are good to go with your, should be able to share your screen now.
And I see you have Marcus there with you.
I do.
Hi, Marcus.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Can you share the screen to the one that says Bob Juergens, not the KDHE one?
Well, this is what, reclaim pumps, there we go, Bob Juergens. There we go, I think so.
There we go, that worked.
Good deal.
All right. How do we use the other?
It did the same thing to me earlier, Bob.
Did it?
Yeah, that's why I switched to just using the plain one.
All right, why don't you go ahead and do that, and then Marcus and I'll tag team on this.
Okay.
So I need to send it back to you.
Nope, I'm good. I got it. There we go. All right.
Okay, there we go. So basically, we just wanted to give an update. And for those of you that don't know me, I'm Bob Juergens. I'm the director of our Bureau of Environmental Remediation. And we've been working on these storage tank regulations for a long time. And when I say we, primarily our storage tank staff. But we finally made progress. Things went live. So go ahead and go to the next slide here. So Sharon Morgan is the storage tank section chief. She's also on. I noticed that I saw her name earlier. And then I've got Marcus Marion in here with me. I'm going to turn it a little bit to catch him here. So we catch him. But anyway, the program staff, Sharon and Marcus, Gary Richardson, and then John Trung with our legal team are very instrumental in getting this to all happen. I just happen to be a bureau director. That's about the only difference here. Go ahead, go to the next slide. So, we did look at, we'll go over the timelines, the regulations, kind of what's new, and then what we're doing for outreach. Next slide. The big thing is July 6th, our regulations went into effect. So we've been working on this for a while. That's the key thing. Our regulations are now in effect and should be followed. Next slide. All right, I'm gonna turn this part over to Mark because he's gonna go over kind of what's new and what are some of the things that you guys can be watching out for.
All right. I'm kind of the stand-in here, so I'm kind of going from Sharon's script. So I'm going to start talking about electronic payments. The new acceptable form of electronic payments is electronic. We can also accept credit cards over the phone. With our new database, online submittals will be available later this year. The previous deferred UST systems, these included emergency power generator, field-constructed tanks, airport hydrants, distribution center systems, water treatment tanks not regulated by the Clean Water Act. The owners of emergency power generators or standby generators are no longer needed to conduct inventory control for their systems, but they are required to conduct monthly monitoring for tank release detection. New definitions. For example, a new definition for drop ticket has been added. There's also a few others that were added along in with it. Application fees for UST permits has been increased in addition to the UST and AST permit late fees have also been increased. One of the fee increases for the installation application, which was last $20, went up to $100. This is the registration for the first year and also for the install. An additional note for the fee increase, historically late fee for UST renewals have been imposed at the beginning of May of each year. According to new regulation amounts, the fee is increased. An additional fee is also added for permits not renewed by August 1st of the year.
So that part's kind of important, I guess, is we were looking at what was going on with quite a few late permits. And so we did we had a late penalty or fee basically previously, but we put it in as a tiered thing. So if we don't have the paperwork by April. Do you remember what the date is?
It was the end of April.
End of April.
Basically the 1st of May.
So then there's a fee. And then we notify folks, say, hey, we didn't get it. And it's an automatic penalty. So it goes into effect. And then if somebody still doesn't have it to us by August, then there's a secondary fee on top of the first one. And those are automated. They're just going to be what happens. So I guess if folks don't turn things in, they know what is there. The penalties are more restrictive. Previously, we were, how much per facility? It's like 10.
It was $10. Late fee was $10 per facility. It's going to $50 a tank now.
Right. So we needed to make it matter. We've seen this in other programs is, somebody is going to be late. If there's a valid reason, I suppose there could be some valid reasons, we are going to listen to that. We still have that option of saying, all right, we understand, and there's not going to be the penalties. But if it's just a matter of not getting it turned in, there are going to be the penalties associated with that.
Okay, under licensing, we changed the licensing around. The cathodic protection and solder and tester were added in. Traditionally, we'd had in the cathodic protection under the installer's license. The tester is now split out from that and actually put under the testing license. We also, in addition, made licenses for the functionality and secondary containment, some of the new testing requirements that came up with the new regulations. On permanent closures, tank owners and operators are required to notify KDHU of changes related to their UST systems. The tank owners and operators can change the status of their tank to temp out, but they will only have 12 months to bring their system back into compliance. Prior to the end of the 12 months, if it's not in compliance, the owner and operator can request an extension for another 12 months, which was traditionally our extended temp out. So at that point in time, they need to do a phase two site assessment, and they will, after completion of the phase two site assessment, they'll have another 12 months. Upon completion of the 24-month period, they either need to bring the system back into compliance or permanently remove it. Okay, next slide. All right, this is more stuff that we're gonna go over individually here. And so next slide. Operator training. Since 2007, KDHE has required operator training. As you are aware, Kansas requires facilities designated operator to be trained as a Class AB operator. The new part of the regulation includes that the A operator resides and be stationed within 4 hours of their managed facilities. The A operator is the Class AB operator in Kansas. The regulation states the Class A operator because the adopted from the federal regulations. The regulations state that, regulations referenced, we would have had to require a complete rewrite of the proportion of the regulations that no longer would no longer get the overall regulation approval. The Class C operator is trained by the Class AB operator. And I'm sorry, I kind of jumbled that up, but basically Kansas, we put the class all in one. So we combine the A and the B, or traditionally a lot of states divide the A and the B out. And that's actually how it's written in the federal regs. So we just made it all one big class instead of dividing the two classes out. And what it says is since we adopted the federal, we still have the A classification and the B classification, even though we train it as an AB in Kansas.
So by default, the AB is the A.
Yes. All right, next slide. All right, SIR. In addition, basically with the new regulations, they brought SIR in. And there was actually quite a bit of talk in the original regulations because the case was that they wanted a 15-day turnaround for SIR. However, industry weighed in and they went back to actually going to 30 days for the submission of SIR. So with that, we also had vapor monitoring. Originally, the original regs came out from the feds and they had that they were no longer going to allow groundwater monitoring or vapor monitoring as an acceptable form of release detection. However, several states popped up, especially Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. And that was one of their primary methods of release detection. And because of that, the feds brought groundwater and vapor monitoring back in. However, we decided not to go with the groundwater or vapor monitoring. And The only exception we have to this is the previously deferred airport hydrant systems or the built-in-place tanks. So, go ahead, next slide. Okay, walkthrough inspections. Facilities requesting to begin conducting monthly walkthrough inspections. Complete the inspection form during the last permitting cycle as a trial run. So for basically the permit we're going into right now was the trial run. So the next year, the ones are actually filling out for 2020 will actually be for permit for the next year. By submitting this at the end of April of each year, the walkthrough inspections completed January through December of 2020, basically what I just said, but basically the 2021 will be for the permit. The testing requirements, the initial tests will no longer be due no later than October 13, 2021. Some of the owners and operators have already started completing the new testing requirements. That is fantastic. Those who have waited will need to get the test scheduled as soon as they can. All failed tests must be reported to KDHE. Optional note on the secondary containment. Secondary containment requires that we were implemented back in 2013 for new installs. These requirements apply to new and replaced tanks. The requirements for interstitial monitoring secondary containment systems, including sumps, and if the sumps were interstitially monitored, UDC containment requirements were effective as of 2016. Next slide. Fuel compatibility. Owners and operators of UST systems storing greater than 10% ethanol or 20% biodiesel must demonstrate fuel compatibility with their system equipment before the product is placed in the system. And this also goes anytime is this for a new system, an existing system, and you have to keep that fuel compatibility demonstration for the lifetime that you have that either above E10 or above B20 in, as long as you have that in your system. Next slide. Flow restrictors and vent lines. Flow restrictors and vent lines have not been allowed in a new installation since 2018. If you have an existing flow restrictor or ball float valve in a vent line that fails, the new overfill protection equipment will be needed to be installed, such as a high level alarm or automatic shutoff. Next slide. Okay.
You want me to talk about that?
Yes, go ahead. You can.
All right. So our KDHE has been working on a new database system that actually will incorporate almost all of the bureau that I do, which is the tanks program, our CERCLA programs, our Bureau of Air is already in it, our Bureau of Water. So that database, we're nearing completion for the tanks program. In August, I think we're going to be pretty comfortable going live, what we're calling a soft live, where internally we're going to be able to use it and then work with a few external stakeholders to start working how the data is going to be able to put in online. This was initially planned to be live by now, but the old system we had is extremely complex and the data conversion has been very difficult. But we're very close to this. Marcus and his staff and some of the other sections have been working real hard on the testing, so it's pretty close. But what it's going to do is allow for online permitting and registration renewals, uploading of any documents. So if you have somebody go out and do some testing, and you have them in the system as a contractor, they'll be able to just upload their testing information if you wanted. You'll be able to see the dates when stuff is due, pretty much at all times, and then submit payments online, either through a credit card or through an ACH, which is electronic check. An electronic check is going to be a cheaper way to do it, because credit card is usually, as you probably well know, 2% or a percentage of the total, whereas the ACH is less than that. So we're looking forward to getting this going, but there's a lot in here, and so we are trying to get this to where it's going to be something that's usable. The key thing is getting it so it's easy enough to use. It's new, so it's not easy to use because nobody is as familiar with it yet. At some point, we would like to go to where all the permitting is done online, but that is down the road a ways. So we're going to allow a combination of online and some paper in the upcoming year or two, three, whatever, however that plays out.
Okay. All right, next slide. All right. SBEEP, which is the K-State Small Business Environmental Assistance Program. KDHE has contracted with the Small Business Environmental Assistance Program, SBEEP, to develop the new storage tank owner and operator guidance manual. This new manual will be straightforward details about federal and state requirements designed in a user-friendly format. SBEEP will have the draft of this manual available to KDHE in August of 2020. In addition, a request has been made for the public hearing for KDHE to develop the request was made during the public hearing for KDHE to develop an at-glance chart for fees related to for USTs. The chart will be included in the manual. It will be available as a standalone document available on our website. Optional. This is to use this to answer a question. Okay, so sorry.
So that fee chart is being created by the K-State SBEEP folks. The owner and operator guidance manual is meant to be something that's very comprehensive and can be easily just set up so it'd be easier for the operators to be able to use it and the owners. And then that fee chart is something we've asked them to fast track so we can get that out sooner. It'd be part of the manual as well, but the idea is to get that fee chart out much sooner and have that available.
All right, next slide. It's our summary here. Go to the next slide. We'll make it to the end here. Now, I already see there's a couple questions here. They popped up over in the corner. I see Jerry and Tom, and I think there was actually somebody else that's gone small on us.
I'll expand it.
Yeah. Charlie, do they actually manage your files and schedule?
So the first question for you guys is from Jerry Davidson on the tank owners.
Okay.
That one. Will tank owners be notified when a closed tank is due for phase two or removed, and will this be enforced on all tank owners?
My understanding is yes. We are going to try to have that as a compliance component in Keene's when we go to the new system. And as part of that, it's supposed to notify the owners that the tank will require a phase two to go. Basically, either they need to bring it into compliance, they can go to a phase two to get an additional year, or they can remove the tank at that time.
So, yeah, there'd be a notification process through that. And the idea is that if somebody logs into Keem's, the owner, they'd be able to see what is out there as well. And then what Marcus is talking about, the system will auto-generate letters and email notifications depending on how we're set up. And that will notify them as well. As far as the enforcement, there's a lot of these tanks out there. And the goal is to be able to get the old tanks out of the ground if they're not going to be used. If it looks like somebody is going to want to use one in the future, that's when we'll work through the 1 to 2 year process. That is something we're going to need to be able to get moving on in the future. That is the direction from our management.
Hey, Bob.
Yes.
Obviously with the legislation last year that getting old tanks out and going to double wall tanks, is there any way that we can make that retroactive because we didn't get to pass it last year?
Yeah, I think Sharon and I talked about that, and we'll have to talk to our legal folks, of course, but our idea is that we will be able to try to make that retroactive. We would support that from the program level, back to the date that we had planned on for this year.
Thank you.
The other question, Marcus and Bob, is Tom got a text message. It says, what is the goal of the above ground tank program? Is it to get as many tanks located and registered as possible, or to make sure every T is crossed and I dotted on the installation?
So we're going to hold off on that one because we have the fire marshal coming up right after lunch, I believe, and that is part of the discussion. So I just don't want to jump in before what Doug's going to talk about.
We will save that question. Is there any other questions for Marcus and Bob? Tom?
I don't have any more. That's a good summary of what we have. Is there a place that has a breakdown of all the fees, Bob and Marcus, on your website?
Not at this time. That new document coming out, we were going to wait until that document came out and then we were going to post it to our web. It was going to be on K-State's web. It was also going to be in that doc, in the document that we're sending out to every owner.
And the estimated time? I know
we had basically middle of August.
Okay. Good.
I did have a little bit of information. I'm trying to get to it right now on the E15 question.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Let me quick grab that up here.
What is the E15 question?
What's the status on the regulations and so forth?
Oh.
And our Bureau of Air has submitted the regulations. They've gone through and they've been double stamped, which means that we've made it through most of the legal review of that. It was submitted over to Department of Administration, which is the next step. And once they approve it, then it'll be able to go out for the, I believe then we'll do the public comment period. The only thing that's in the way is, as Dr. Norman talked about earlier, there's a lot of stuff out there for the COVID response, including some of this contract tracing regulations and stuff associated with that. So the E15, although it's a priority, we want to get it through. It has some even higher priority stuff in front of it that they're trying to work through. But we're continuing to watch it, and the goal is to get those regulations completed.
Okay. There's another question that just popped up.
Is KDHE considering eliminating the 7-pound gasoline requirement in Wyandotte and Johnson County?
Do you know that one?
I believe that's a Johnson and Wyandotte County regulation. That's not one of ours.
No, that's the same one that we talked about with Leo early last year.
Okay.
Because that's where the E15 would come in and would act as a replacement to the 7-pound. And I think Missouri went and passed regulation that allowed in those counties that allowed that. Is that true?
Good question. Leo and Rick Brunetti have been working on that, and so I don't know the answer, but we can find out and get that to you, Tom.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that at this point they were going to do a test case, and then they had to do a study, and that was all completed. And I don't remember seeing anything more about it, so I'm glad the question came back up. Because I believe Missouri's already passed it to where, and we want the two states to be similar, I would believe, with regard to E15 in Kansas City area.
Yeah.
Because the pricing differential would be disastrous for any bordering counties or cities, excuse me. So, yeah, if you'd follow up on that, that'd be great.
All right, we'll do.
One other question regarding the new testing. Are standard forms available on your website for submitting those results?
We have the forms we've had out there since we went to the double wall. However, with our new Keems, one of the things that Keems made us do is go back through and redo all our forms. So the forms that we've traditionally have, the numbering system, will get changed around a little bit because we had to combine a couple forms. We had to reorganize them, so the numbering system for the forms will get reorganized. However, the same forms will be out there.
Yeah, part of the process was doing what we call quality improvement and looking at the forms and seeing if there's ways to combine them. And by being able to use electronic forms, we can save a lot of time filling out, information that's just repeated on some of the forms. So we'll get that information out. That's the goal, is to be able to hopefully streamline some of this and make the submittal a little bit easier. Like I said, it's new, so change is always hard sometimes, but the goal is to have something that's going to be usable by everybody.
Okay. Other questions? I don't see any more popping up.
No. Nope.
Well, Bob and Marcus, really appreciate your time. And as always, we appreciate the good working relationship between the industry and the agency, and that will continue on. And as long as we have open line of communication, which you've always been easy to access, both of you, everybody in your department. So we appreciate all you're doing for us, as well as under trying times with few people in the office here and there, and especially during permit times, got to be a lot of fun right now.
Okay.
But I just wanted to thank you again.
Yeah, no problem. And we'll be back on for Doug's presentation. What time is that starting?
12:45. So we're going to take a lunch, everybody, at 12 here in just a second. And then we'll be back at 12:45 with the fire marshal, and KDH, you guys will be on back then too.
Okay.
Great. All right. Let's take a lunch break and we'll go from there. We want to keep on time because we told people of these. We have people getting on and off throughout these presentations. So we'll be back at 12:45.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. if you're ready.
Yes.
Okay, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, thanks for the invite, as always. And we do appreciate the working relationship I think we have with your association. And we want to try and always continue that and to foster that and to improve on that. So I'll just hit a couple highlights that we want to make all of your members aware of, and then open it up for any questions. The first thing I wanted to share is we've been getting some questions or concerns on the use of railroad tanks for storage. And we currently have the 2008 version of NFPA 30 and 58 adopted. And the use of a railroad car tank for above ground storage or permanent storage is not prohibited in that addition. And so we have a couple of new inspectors that have cited that, but we have taken care of that with them. And they're now aware of what the 08 edition says. There are newer editions of NFPA 30 and 58 that do prohibit the use of rail tank cars, but we have not adopted any of those. We're still in the 08 edition. As we move forward into new editions, we will basically grandfather those rail tank cars and allow them to remain in operation until the facility makes any type of change, until they move it, do any additional welding or any repairs or anything else like that. And then we'll take a look at that particular tank at that time. But we're going to grandfather them even as we move forward into the 2018 and newer codes. We will still allow the use of those rail tank cars going forward. And then I mentioned 2018. You know, a year or so ago, we put our committee together that you had members on, and we shared all the new 2018 rules and regs that we're going to move forward into, and we have actually submitted those. Okay. And currently, they're either at the Division of Budget's office or at the AG's office for review. So we are moving forward with the 2018 changes, and we'll see how that goes with the legislature and the Joint Committee on Rules and Regs when they have any future meetings. But we'll keep everybody updated on how that process is proceeding and if there's any issues that we're coming across. And there will be, as you know, per the guidelines, at some point in time, there will be a public hearing. So if there are some things that have come up since our advisory group met and sort of signed off on our current version of the 18 regs, then we'll be able to address those at that point in time too. And as soon as we get a good draft done and we get it set up to do the publication, the public publication, we'll make sure and also send them out to you electronically so you can distribute it to all your members, and we'll take feedback at that time too. So that's pretty much it. And then continuing on the rules and regs, you know, since we are in the 2008 edition, we have taken the position that we are allowing variances on anything that new regs come out that benefit the industry. So, you know, whether it's the 2012, 2016, whatever version of the regs that are out there, if the industry finds anything that's a benefit to the industry over the current 2008 edition, we can't do a blanket variance for the industry as a whole based on the statutes that are currently in place. But we can do a variance that just needs to be asked for by each individual company. and we will then look at that variance based on that individual company's circumstances. And we wanna, we're doing that with other groups in the state, other people that we inspect and regulate. And so I just wanted to make your members aware of it, that if there's anything that benefits the industry that we can help with, we will do those variances and adopt the newer version of the rules and regs. And I don't think there's anything in 2018 that's actually more restrictive for your industry. I think there are a number of things that are less restrictive. And so even as we adopt 2018, when the next version comes out, if there's anything, again, that benefits the industry, we'll look at those on a case-by-case basis too. And I think, is Bob on, back on? Yeah, I see him. We've actually met with KDHE, and you know, Bob mentioned their new software, and he thinks that new software package will allow us to basically streamline and maybe even simplify the above ground tank storage issues that we're having, and make it easier for the industry to submit that initial paperwork and simplify the process. We've had one meeting with KDHE, and we're going to have more as they move into their new software package. And I think Bob can explain it probably a lot better than I can. But when we visited before, there's a possibility, and I'll emphasize possibility, that we might be able to accept a Google photo. And then with their new software, they can actually move that into the local city plat and have all the measurements and the different things that we need to then approve it from neighbors and from property lines and things like that. So that's what we're looking at. That's where we're trying to get to. But again, it's a new software package, and we'll be working with them on that. But we hope to, you know, as soon as we can, sort of put that in place again, just to help manage the above ground tanks. And then on the question that was asked during Bob's presentation, I visited with Brenda and Randy, who are on the call with us this morning. And for now, just to identify the tanks that are out there that we're not aware of, we're okay with just the different owners submitting a Google picture with an address and not needing all the measurements and everything right now. We just want to identify the tanks that are out there that we're not aware of. And then as we move forward working with KDHE, we'll work on the rest of it at that point in time. But I think it'll just be a big help, at least for our office, and I think for KDHE, to be more aware of the number of tanks we do have out there that have never been registered and where they're actually at. So, and I think that's about all I have, unless anybody has any questions.
Do you have a list of the different codes that every county's different? Their fire code's different, or it appears to me it is. Because I get calls that sometimes where they're different than the 2008 code or NFPA 30, I'm talking about, obviously. And is there any consistent, I'm not even sure how to ask the question, why don't we all have the same code in every county that we're dealing with when we start talking about 2018?
Because of home rule?
I don't like home rule.
I understand, but actually... Because there's the state adopted version of the codes, but there's actually a statute that allows local municipalities and counties to be more stringent if they choose. Now they can't be less stringent, which is probably not a benefit to your industry, but they can be more stringent. So, and we don't have a list of all the different counties and what their rules and regs are. We have an idea on some because we answer a lot of questions from not only your industry, but from other groups on how come the county's telling them they need to do this, but the state code says they don't have to. So unfortunately, unless the legislature does something, there's no way around that sort of misinformation that's out there because of that, since those counties can be more stringent if they choose. And we find that all the time, especially in the larger metro areas, in the smaller areas, and in some parts of the state, you know, those cities and counties don't even have codes. Yeah. So they rely on the state ones. But that's going to be an ongoing issue simply because of home rule. There's not much we can do about that.
Yeah, it always poses a problem. I get a phone call and I go, what program are you under? What rule are you under? And
what county are you in? What city are you in? Because yeah. The cities can even be more stringent than the county, who's more stringent than the state. So
right. It
is a little bit of a headache, but if at any point in time, you know, that issue comes up, if you want to let us know, we can reach out to that city or county and see what current regs they have adopted, and then be able to share with you guys the differences between the current state regs so that your marketers in that particular county or city have a better understanding of what's required for them locally.
Is there anything coming up? Is there anything coming up next session that, depending on how long the damn session will last next year, who knows, that you need to bring forward that would impact underground tank or above ground tank owners?
There's nothing on our list, any changes that we're looking at. And Brenda and Randy can correct me or jump in here if I'm wrong, but the only piece of legislation that our office currently is introducing is to clarify the law enforcement authority of our fire investigators. And besides that, that was something that's been in the last two sessions and didn't get addressed. So we're going to have to reintroduce it. And hopefully we have that chance. But, you know, unless something comes up or if there's something that your industry or another industry or group wants to address, you know, we're willing to visit ahead of time and see if we can't work it out so that when and if that legislation does get introduced, that everybody's on the same page and we can just help expedite getting it through the session.
Okay, good. Are there any questions in the grid?
There are not.
Any? Surely there's got to be somebody out there with a question.
Well, I can talk a little bit about what Doug was saying. Is we're going to be able to use some ArcGIS mapping within our database, and then even exterior from that if we wanted to. So, you know, working with the Google aerial photography and identifying the, you know, the tank numbers and stuff like that, we've got some options that are going to be available to us. And so if there's somebody has a tank farm with, you know, a bunch of tanks and that's something that might work, you know, they can work with the fire marshal's office, they can work with KDHE, we can help put that together to try to simplify that process. We're going to be talking to our database designers to see about our options for what we call cloning forms, registration forms. So if somebody is able to have, let's say somebody has 12 tanks that they need to do, you know, we can go through and put the facility information in there and go to one. And if you can clone that and then just change the relevant information, that can save a lot of time. We need to find out. I don't think that's currently in there, so that might be an enhancement that we need to do. But that is something we would look forward to. And those are the kind of things that we're going to want from our stakeholders, from the users, on trying to identify efficiencies down the road. Because we know this is going to be a living database that will change as we see better ways that we can do things.
Great.
Do I have one question for you? Does your department provide local fire departments training on gas spill cleanup?
We do, and so does KU Fire and Training, but it's not required training, so it's up to the individual departments to request that. The individual, there's no required training for fire departments in the state. The retraining for each department is left up to the chief himself. So there's no requirements on training. There's no certifications required for training. So it's left up to each individual department. But if a department does want that training, yes, they can contact us. We can either do it ourselves or we can get them in touch with KU Fire and Training. I think KU Fire and Training is starting to do their training again, their in-person training, but we can do a lot of that online too. So the training's available. They just need to ask us for it because we can't mandate it.
Okay. Yeah.
Through your inspections, Doug, are you seeing any consistent problems out there or anything major we need to be alerting our members to?
I'm going to let Brenda and Randy take over. I'm going to actually drop out here because I have my daily 1 o'clock call with the Emergency Operations Center and the county emergency managers, and they're going to be much more well-versed on that than I am. But any questions, concerns you guys have, please always share those with us, and we'll do our best to figure something out going forward. So.
Super. Well, I appreciate your time and efforts as well. So good luck in your emergency call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug.
So the most of what we see is just general maintenance issues. Nothing that sometimes we'll get into some of the bigger ticket items, but most of it is just maintenance, tanks painted, lines, make sure that they have the product name on the lines. We did get into some fusible links. Randy, I can't remember off the top of my head. Most of them were, you know, just general maintenance type of situations. So nothing too big other than the rail car issue did come up. But I think we can address that through each individual company as it comes up. So
okay.
And the fusible link issue that she's addressed, we had a few issues where they were using one of them. We had vice grips used on the pump where, you know, the fusible link gave out. So it's a weekend and the station themselves did this, and you know, those are the kind of things you want to watch. And a lot of them are on a maintenance program where we don't have that issues. Sometimes that's the smaller stations or private owned ones that where we find those kind of things. Another thing we find a lot is putting products out on the islands, combustibles, things like that. They want to make sure that all your combustibles are 20 feet away from your islands. Other than that, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of consistent issues.
Okay. Just curious, since we don't have a lot, I haven't heard a lot from people, so I don't know what that means. Either they're really in good shape or I don't know. It's been pretty quiet, so that's
good. Well, now you jinxed it, so.
I'll start hearing from people going,
what
they want.
You're in trouble now. But I think everybody, pretty much has been doing really well. We've did all of our inspections, you know, throughout the summer, and COVID kind of slowed us down a little bit. But with the fuels and the propane, we were able to handle those because those weren't inside building type situations. And so we felt like that was a safe way to go. But I think most everything has been, you know, going really well. It's just we hit a little bumps once in a while, but we're able to work through them and keep on going. So.
Good. All right. Well, I don't know that I have any other questions. I'm looking at the board here.
Doesn't look like it.
No. Well, Brenda and Randy, appreciate you being on. And
thank you.
As well as the fire marshal, just sitting there for Doug, giving us his insight and what's going on. And I'm glad everything's quiet. So let's keep it that way.
All right. Sounds good to us. Thank you very much.
You betcha.
So, Katie, she's going to drop off unless you need anything else.
Nope. I think we're good.
All right. Thanks a lot. I've got to go to the same call, Doug's.
All righty. Well, thanks again. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
All right.
Now, how do we do this now with a group talk here?
Okay, so what you guys should be able to unmute yourself, or if you're having problems, you can just send me a message and I can unmute, it, as opposed to me unmuting everybody and then getting all the background noise. So you should be able to unmute yourself, and then we can go from there. Tom, I'll just let you go.
Well, we talked a little bit about the legislative session, and obviously nothing really happened. This year we were involved in about 9 different bills, ranging from all the underground storage tank bills to electric charging stations, to T21, Tobacco 21, tax credits for alternative fuel. And obviously, as I said, nothing passed last session. So it bodes well to have a very, very busy next session. Picking up where we left off and potential budget issues, which mean they'd be looking for money. So that's always a huge concern. The transportation, I think I put in my newsletter yesterday, the day before, they're out. I think they have 24 confirmed projects they're working on, or 26. So obviously they have enough motor fuel tax money to complete those projects. They are private public projects, which means that the local communities are sharing in some of the cost. As I said, tax increases. I was asked to talk about no chance gaming. I will tell you that last session we were involved with the sports book or sports gaming. For C stores, where you put a machine in and you could bet on a game, basically win or lose a football game or baseball game. And I can tell you that the chairman of the Federal State Affairs Committee, John Barker, he's the one that's really wants us in the middle of all that that whole thing. We've always told the state, the lottery, that if the lottery is involved, every lottery retailer should have the ability to participate in any type of game that the lottery has available. So Barker is all for that. There's a big faction. All the casinos don't want us involved in anything. So at least for next year, there's every intent that will be put in a bill again for sports gaming or a sports book, if you will. But then I heard about no chance gaming, and there's a big controversy. I guess there's a bunch of lawsuits on it. But Missouri is home to a bunch of casinos that feature slot machines, and no chance gaming is something similar to that. So I don't know if Brenda Ellsworth's on the phone or not, or if she's with us today, but she's the one that brought it up, and I don't know what everybody I don't know a lot about it, but other than the fact that it's kind of like a gray machine, and we've had problems with gray machines in Kansas before about them being illegal. But I don't know if this compares to the sports book that we tried to do last session or not. But that's the only issue that people have given me or sent me, or it's a topic they want to discuss when I ask for what topics does everybody want to talk about today. So. The floor is open. Or if you want to talk about something else.
I don't think anybody wants to talk.
Well, evidently there's no issues out there at this point, I guess. That's the bigger thing. I will also say that for the convention, we still have the convention plan for September 28th through 30th, just FYI, at the Prairie Bank Casino, unless obviously something changes with the state of Kansas, the county of Mayetta, whatever that, Jackson County, or Shawnee County. We will abide by what they say. Obviously, masks right now are required everywhere you go, inside and outside. So that has posed somewhat of a problem for large groups meeting. People don't want to do that. So then those meetings get, those functions get canceled. So at this point, the committee has met, and the convention is still on as we speak.
Tom, what about the kilowatt hour charging bill that we had?
That'll be up from what I told last year. We worked with ChargePoint on that bill last year. It had a hearing, and it was on general orders to be worked, and of course the session ended. ChargePoint, they still want to go forward with that. Basically what that does, it changes the definition of public utility. And more specific, it changes the definition of public utility when it deals with electric charging machines, specifically to that. Because KCC is the only one that can regulate the cost of a kilowatt hour. Nobody else can. So in other words, if you want to charge at those electric charging machines, we've got to pass this legislation first to make that happen, to make it legal. Otherwise, you can call it a commission, you can call it a service fee to have the machine there, but it's just not very clean that way. So as far as I know, ChargePoint is still want to move forward with that bill. I don't know how to mute that.
There's a D&D button on your phone.
I got it. So what else does everybody have in their mind? Whether it's convention or motor fuel or transportation, retail.
Wonder how many people are actually listening.
Well, you got 32 people still on the horn, on the line. You had 41 a little bit ago.
We are working on a survey to send out to everybody about our first ever Zoom meeting. So you guys can hopefully fill that out and give us your honest, brutal truth of how you felt it went, even though we all know we'd rather be in person, but sometimes we just can't do that. So we will be sending that out.
So Tom, Becky, this Patrick, what did you think of the fire marshal's thoughts about that they do not provide any training to local fire departments on gasoline spills or cleanups?
That is a problem.
What are you seeing? What do you hear?
I haven't heard a word. As I said earlier, I have not heard from anybody, but at the same time, it doesn't surprise me with their limited staff. But yeah, I was a little shocked when he said that.
There was a competitor of ours, it's probably been a year ago, they had a spill at the station across the street from one of our stores, and was driving by and saw the local fire department out there. And like most local fire departments, first thing they do is get the water hoses out and wash it down.
Yep.
And I yelled at one of the guys there and I said, "Hey, what are you doing?" He said, "Well, we're washing this down." I said, "You can't do that." He said, "Oh no, we have this chemical we can put on there that disperses the gasoline." I said, "Boy, I need some of that. Whatever that chemical is, I need some."
Really? I've not heard that. Jeez. Well, it's interesting that the KDHE and the fire marshal will, if you have a bunch of tanks out there, just get a Google picture and add the address, and they're good to go to get that started, as opposed to filling out all the paperwork. Okay. I'm not hearing from anybody.
Tommy, you have a comment, and Charlie Robinson sent you a comment too. He's got to get his glasses on to read.
Can I make a full turn? Are you giving strokes? I've been given a lot of strokes, and I'm paying out a lot of money because it seems like all the guys I'm playing when they're my partner, they don't play well. And when they're against me, they play like a record, like a pro. So what else? What does Butch have here? Okay, the Zoom meeting. We're going to put out a – did you just say a survey, Becky?
Yeah.
A little different, but the intent for a lot of this stuff is to get everybody together. I don't know when that's going to happen again, but also that this offers the opportunity for everybody to talk about problems or whatever with the entire group. And short of not having speakers each time, which I thought they were good. It was good to hear from Christina. It's good to hear from the Secretary Norman. It's super those people to give us their time, especially when they're very, very busy. But having said that, we work closely with them, and that I think that's why I don't know that they feel obligated to be on the horn, but it was good to have them there.
We will post Christina's website and a couple of documents that I've gotten from her on our website, as well as the presentations from KBHE and the hours of service with Gary. We will post all of those on our website as well. If there are topics that you guys want to have a 30-minute hour Zoom meeting on, and we can find speakers, send them to Tom or I, and we'd be glad to arrange them. Like I said, this is our first Zoom. We've done some other ones, so we're still perfecting the system, but let us know, because they are easy to get together. People tend to have the time to be able just to buzz in real quick and give a presentation. So if there are other ones, I know Charlie and I talked about doing a file one, what needs to be in your driver's files. So hopefully we can get that done. So, and
we could actually plan something maybe 4 weeks from now or something like that, Becky, and do a Zoom meeting, a 20-minute meeting or a 25-minute meeting, so we're not taking a whole day of everybody's out of their spend a whole lot of time out of everybody's busy day. So maybe we start planning some of these and see how they work. It's kind of hard to have a refreshment right now with nobody being here, but we might have one anyway. But we'll think everybody.
So shoot us some topics, guys.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
Great job putting this together in a week's notice of changing over to Zoom. Like I said, we just now need to perfect the Zoom cocktail hour.
Y'all got to turn on your cameras.
Well, we'll work on that, Kurt.
Can we get Dr. Norman's speech? Did you record that?
Yes, I did. And as soon as I figure out how to send that, Charlie, okay, I will post that as well.
All right. You're doing well. Thank you.
I recorded the whole thing, so we should hopefully be able to do that.
Thank you.
No problem.
I was pleasantly surprised with the personality of Dr. Norman for a secretary. I expected something very, very different, but he was very off the cuff, and some of his comments were interesting, or his actions too, but I'd like to get to know him better. I don't know him other than saying hi to him and congratulations. So I don't know if my work's cut out for me, but I'd like to spend more time with him to get to know him. And KDHE has been working closely with us on, as I said, these legislative proposals, but also on the underground storage tank stuff. They asked for a lot of input from stakeholders, and we provided that. So my hat's off to everybody that helped participate in that. Well, I don't want to. I'm hearing too many crickets, so I guess at this point we will sign off. And if people have comments, they can send us by email. That'd be great, and we'll go from there. But I appreciate everybody's time today and 3 hours of Zoom, 3 hours and 18 minutes of Zoom. So we're on a first fast track to technology here. So y'all have a good day.